What is up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Uncanny, the unofficial X-Men 97 podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Condon, and today we're going to be talking about part two of the three-part finale entitled Tolerance is Extinction. So, as you saw in the last episode, we have kind of moved towards what I like to call a tipping point from a socio-political standpoint, where one party takes an action that you can't come back from. You know, again, spoilers if you haven't watched any of the episodes so far, and definitely haven't watched this episode, I'm going to have to get into spoilers because that's kind of the name of the game. So if you don't want to hear what happened in the episode, if you haven't yet watched X-Men 97, which is what this podcast show and discussion show is about, please pause, go and meditate for like 20 minutes. All right, for those of you that are still on the episode, we're going to start in 1, 2, and 3. So, as I like to start most of my review episodes, we're going to be going over the awesome X-Men 97 intro, because it's like my favorite part of the show. And in this intro, again, much like in the past three episodes, the only main difference is subtle. And that subtlety in this intro is Storm's new costume. Oh my gosh, I freaking love it. So Storm is shown in the intro wearing her brand new, amazing, I would say throwback to Pride of the X-Men costume. It's this awesome, like, satin black, kind of like one piece, like, I'd say it's very bathing suit-like, but I think that'd probably be a little unnecessarily vague. Just awesome, awesome X-Men costume. And, you know, though we do see it in her intro, they didn't animate the new costume into the running montage that kind of finishes the intro overall. So, I mean, you can't ask for the animators to do everything. But I do love the look of this new costume for Storm. I think it's a very, very cool look. It's definitely something that I think a lot of fans are going to very much appreciate, as it is a nod back to an animation pilot that unfortunately was not given the green light, which was Pride of the X-Men. This was a pilot that was put out by Marvel Comics before it was Marvel Studios, I think back in the early 90s. And it was a great story. It featured characters from the show that we know now, but also others like Dazzler and Colossus. And it also features the main protagonist of Kate or Kitty Pryde. So that was never picked up. Not sure why. I mean, you know, you can still watch it today. I actually have it on VHS, which is crazy that I actually have that, because I was a huge fan growing up of the series. It's one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast, because X-Men was always near and dear to my heart and was such a formulative part of my identity growing up. And I just, you know, I love the series, and I'm just glad that they, you know, chose to renew the series in 2024. So yeah, Aurora's costume, the black kind of leather costume, it is definitely inspired by Aurora's original costume in the comics, but yes, her costume from Pride of the X-Men. It's amazing to think that Marvel Comics, now Marvel Studios, has gotten to a point where they can take these kind of risks. You know, and you can criticize Disney and what Disney chooses to do, like, you know, with writers, namely Bo DeMeo, which I talked about in my last review episode, but having the autonomy, technically, to pursue these kind of more risky projects wouldn't be possible without Disney kind of buying the property and then giving them a bit of a hands-off, well, somewhat of a hands-off approach. So, as we start the main part of the show, part two of Tolerance's Extinction, we see the Xavier Mansion in shambles, just absolutely devastated. And we see Charles Xavier, who looks like he really needed a long night's sleep, waking up to his baby, his home, literally, that he turned into a school, just destroyed from the Prime Sentinel attack. We see Magneto or Magnus kind of standing on this outcropping of rocks, just kind of looking out to, I'm assuming, what is like refugee boats from Genosha that are having to flee because there's just no infrastructure to support life, right? And then we see Bastion crying over his mother because she's been turned off by Magneto. The end of last episode, he puts out a EMP or electromagnetic pulse and just nerfs all the electronics, all the technology around the world, which is bad. And they're saying in this episode that the world's going to end, quote, and I'm assuming that what is not said is that it's because that's how long our generators are going to last. Assuming. Just, we can't sustain our life as we know it without power, without electricity. You know, this is kind of, definitely a scary thing, you know, to think that if someone devised an electromagnetic weapon and just targeted a, you know, a major city, think about all the countless who would die. Hospitals, food safety, like everything, infrastructure. I mean, our friggin' stoplights. Like it's crazy how dependent we are as a civilization on electricity. I think that's kind of understated in this show. We see Aurora and Forge come to rescue a fleeing Jubilee and Sunspot, or Roberto da Costa, who are being assaulted by a mob of Friends of Humanity and other angry humans who are like, look at what you mutants did. You shut off the lights. Now we care, but we're going to attack you. And Forge and Aurora, again, in Aurora's awesome OG costume, come in, save the day, assuming, you know, because we jetpack over to the Xavier Mansion. And Scott and Jean are giving Xavier a little bit of a teardown, I guess. You know, he's taking it as much as he can. He's just kind of sitting there looking out on the horizon. And Scott's like, you gave the keys to the Cadillac to a man who may or may not have an extreme version of bipolar disorder. What were you thinking, Chuck? And Xavier's like, I thought better angels, yada, yada. It's like, this is a plot device, of course. Like, what is he going to say? I made a boo-boo? You know, in reality, he's like, I kind of just wanted to have a life. And I wanted you to have a life. Scott, you guys haven't had a life. I've essentially been your, like, main father figure and or, I guess, like, general? I mean, how do you even describe what Xavier was to the X-Men? Like, yeah, he was the headmaster. It was a functioning college, right? Xavier's Home for Gifted Youngsters. It was essentially a college program that housed mutants and taught mutants legitimately like math, history, economics, and also how to, you know, control their powers. You know, and then Scott and Jean were the first students of Charles, who essentially didn't really have an opportunity to have a life. Couldn't have kids. They couldn't, you know, have their own house. They couldn't do what they chose to do. They didn't have any choice. They felt responsible to carry out Xavier's dream. And I think in this moment, the writer does kind of bring us down that path. As many people, I guess, in this situation could relate to Scott and Jean wanting to have a life. But Scott's also like, what kind of life do you want us to have? If we left and, you know, bought a home in freaking Ipswich, like, we'd probably come back to the mansion because, hey, this is our universe. We're always getting, like, bombarded by gamma rays or, you know, visited by space aliens or fighting giant robots. It's kind of interesting that they're trying to play the drama here while also being completely cognizant of the fact that this is a cartoon. Like, this is based on a comic. Comic book characters don't really get to retire. Like, the IP requires that they constantly fight something. I mean, it is very meta when you think about it. Like, you know, Wolverine, if he was a real person, would probably, like, need severe psychiatric help. Because he's always angry. He's always fighting. And Charles Xavier is like legitimately sending, you know, the people that he considers family and students to potentially their death on a daily basis. It's a lot. It's a lot for anyone to handle, much less a guy who is severely disabled, requiring a wheelchair, is paralyzed from the waist down. Like, unpack that a little bit. It's like a lot. Anywho, so Scott walks off pissed, typical Scott. You know, and Jean is there to be like, I'll just stand here, Professor, and not say anything by doing that. You know, I got your back, I guess. We see Rogue wake up from her, I guess, coma from getting whacked by Bolivar Trask's prime sentinel form. And Kurt is there, like in the room, just kind of reading, I'm assuming the Bible, because they're going to be right on the nose on that. Like, I think he was reading the Bible. Like, I'm going to have to, like, go back to the actual tape and look and see what he was reading. I'm assuming it's the Bible because, you know, he's Catholic and us Catholics, all we read is the Bible, right? We're not reading, like, I don't know, Dune or, like, Clockwork Orange. You can't tell what he's reading. It's just, like, a generic book. Okay, we don't know what he was reading. I'm going to say maybe T.S. Eliot. Who knows? So he puts down The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and he goes and talks to his stepsister, who's like, hey, stepsis, there's just a lot that's gone on while you've been unconscious. So we're in a bit of a pickle, because the guy who you've been sleeping with, who's also been our headmaster for, like, months, he's actually alive. He didn't die in Genosha. Oh, and he, like, set off an EMP and nerfed all technology worldwide, killing millions. So you might want to unpack that. Like, that's an awkward conversation. We see Aurora and Roberto and Jubilee and Forge come back to the mansion because it's like, you know, it's like the safe place, apparently, while, you know, they're cleaning up the rubble. And it's nice to see Jean and Aurora kind of hug it out midair because they can both fly. Very, very, very cute. And they're just like, yeah, we're cleaning up the mansion. It's kind of a mess. Sorry, folks. Like, hey, sorry that the house is a mess. We just got attacked by hundreds of killer robots. That's got to, you know, who, I mean, Xavier must be like very, very rich because, you know, they've had to rebuild the mansion like 3 times and the dude doesn't seem to really have any source of income because, I don't know, I mean, was the school lucrative when it was running? Was it like a private school? Like, I don't know. I'm not going to dig into that. But anywho, yeah, the Xavier Mansion is just devastated. And they are going to have to relocate to Muir Island. So that's a nice little plug. So Muir Island is run by Charles Xavier's, I guess, one of his love interests, Moira MacTaggert, who I think, I don't know if she's still alive. Did she die in Genosha? I don't know. I mean, I saw her body on the ground next to Banshee, who I think was her husband or boyfriend. So I don't even know if Moira is still alive. But apparently, they have access to Muir Island, and someone at Muir Island is still paying the bills, keeping the lights on, keeping the cobwebs swept. So I'm assuming Moira is alive. Maybe? You know, they didn't really go into that. But I do want to just note how much I love seeing the X-Men assembled moment in this decrepit mansion. Like, just seeing, like, everyone just sitting on these old chairs, like, around, like, a cork board with, like, little sticky things in it. It's just so quaint. You know, everyone's just kind of like, you know, we're the X-Men, and we got to do something about this because that's what we do. Logan's all like, I'm just going to stab something. Such a one-trick pony. And Charles Xavier's like, Logan, dude, like, freaking, are you kidding me? Like, you just, yeah, let's just stab things and that'll be the solution to everything. You know, because Charles Xavier is kind of like the worst kind of pacifist because he actually sends his students out to fight, physically fight other mutants. Again, I'm not going to unpack that, but he was supposed to be modeled after Martin Luther King Jr. Nonviolent political protest. Non-violent, which means no violence. Like, we shouldn't be fighting at all. I mean, if Xavier is supposed to be based on MLK, you know, the school would just remain a school and they wouldn't fight anything, but then, you know, they'd get wiped out, I guess, and then that would be it. Anywho, we see all the X-Men assembled. I love seeing Nightcrawler there. Just still, it's just so, it tickles me pink to have Nightcrawler just now included as a mainstay in the X-Men universe. So cool, because that's always the way it was. And I'm just assuming again, and I mentioned this in my previous review series, that they replaced Nightcrawler with Morph in the first iteration of this X-Men animation. I'm only assuming because maybe they didn't want to have someone who was overtly religious in the show. You know, maybe they saw a tie between religious identity and extremism or something. You know, and Morph, I guess, was a more interesting character because you just turn into everything, which we see at the end of this episode. Very cool. In this kind of meeting motif, we see Roberto in his, check this, new mutant costume. That's right. He's wearing his new mutant costume. So, you know, this is like a nod to the comics. So Roberto was a part of the New Mutants cadre of students, along, and I believe I talked about this before, along with Ileana Rasputin, or Magic, Sam Gumfrey as Cannonball, Rain Sinclair as Wolfsbane, you know, Roberto de Costa as Sunspot. I believe you have Karma, who was a Vietnamese mutant, and then you had Moonstar, Daniel Moonstar, as, I think they called her, you know, they just called her Daniel Moonstar, but I think her name was like Mirage or something, who was an Indigenous American. And they were like a major kind of branding and marketing move by Marvel to try and be more showcasing not only international characters, but characters from international communities that are oftentimes not given any kind of time of day. Like Roberto was from Brazil, right? Karma was from Vietnam. But yes, so in this kind of Xavier Mansion kind of hodgepodge, Roberto was wearing what the New Mutants wore as a team. So they were kind of like another X-Men team. So, you know, just, again, the whole premise of X-Men is a little, we're peace-loving peaceniks, yet we form teams and go on missions that often involve violence and death. It's like, I know, it's a comic book. I get it. So, you know, we see some chatter between Beast and Forge, because they're both, like, techies. You know, it's always nice when you meet another tech nut. I consider myself a tech nut, just because I love technology. I teach as an adjunct at a university, media studies, which is one of the reasons why I like talking about movies. If I ever meet another tech nut, you know, who's like another audiophile or something, there's always chemistry. So it's nice to see Beast and Forge kind of have like their bro moment. And then we see Rogue kind of brooding out near the Xavier Mansion grounds lake, talking about Remy and how, you know, Remy died, and she's wearing an outfit that I think I'm amazed they did this. I'm happy they did this. She's wearing her like original X-Men outfit before the original X-Men series kind of codified what we now consider the quintessential Rogue look. And this was an outfit that she wore when she was with the Brotherhood of Mutants, who were run by, yes, Magneto, who we see coming down from the sky with, I'm only assuming, Asteroid M. That's right. Magneto goes up into space and drags down Asteroid M, which was his, I guess, original plan for a mutant colony, but not, you know, an island like Genosha, but up in space, I guess, protected by some kind of gravitational force field. And, you know, he's got his helmet on. He's looking like the Magneto that we all love and hate. The Aurora Borealis, or Northern Lights, is kind of circling this asteroid because, you know, Magneto has magnetic powers. And we are in our OG Xavier v. Magneto dichotomy, where you have Xavier, who's more tolerant and is about coexistence and about dialogue, and Magneto, who's like, fuck dialogue, we should just rule. And like, X-Men, like that's the thing. You know, so I'm assuming that this whole series was to get us to this point of understanding why Magneto is the way he is, right? Magneto's not just bad guy. We saw his journey towards, I guess, being a terrorist again, right? And he's doing all of this. He's creating another asteroid M. I mean, he didn't call it that, but that's what it is, because of Genosha. Because he saw firsthand what happened in Genosha. And he's like, the humans are just going to do this again and again and again. We've tried peace. We've tried love. Obviously, it doesn't work. We're just going to let the Earth go into chaos without electricity, and we'll live in space orbiting the planet until all the humans just fight each other to death and we come back and repopulate. Like, it's pretty mean. This is pretty dark. But that's Magneto. So all y'all who were like really rooting for Magneto as the good guy, this is Magneto. This is who he's always been, you know, and this is his default. And we see bum 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 with lightning blasts, Rogue chooses to join Magneto on Asteroid M. She's fed up with being a peacenik. She doesn't care anymore. She's lost too much. And she also has that, like, Magneto magnetism. Like, they were sleeping together. Like, she obviously was also a fan of the creature comfort. So she just, yeah, well, you know, screw all the humans and screw this Xavier Dream bullshit. I'd rather just, you know, be able to have sex and live on a floating asteroid. All right, it's a bit of... Would Rogue do that? I mean, maybe if she was that traumatized? Interesting choice, but I guess from a plot standpoint, it does kind of make sense. She did technically just murder a bunch of people 2 episodes ago when she was just like going on a tirade to find Bolivar Trask. So like, if she's capable of murder... She's also capable of joining Magneto and planning a human genocide. That's what they're going to do. And they're like, well, we had genocide occurring against us, so we're just going to do the same back at the humans. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Because that works well, doesn't it? Isn't that what Gandhi said? Oh no, Gandhi was warning about eye for an eye and how it leads to mutual destruction. Yes, as we see here. Oh, and to the listener who thinks that I'm the reincarnation of Ted Kaczynski, why? Because when anyone talks about social issues in a way that isn't, you know, overtly racist or demonizing, that they're like the Unabomber. Interesting. Yeah, someone left that as a comment on the podcast. Oh, wow. I guess you know you're doing something right when someone calls you the Unabomber? What? Aside, I know. Anywho, back to the show. We see Roberto. Yes, Sunspot chooses to go as well with Magneto into his evil asteroid. I guess that makes sense. Like, I mean, his mom did kind of just sell him out to evil robots. So I guess he is now kind of trauma bonding too, like with Rogue. So I guess the moral of this story is, don't let your trauma inform the decisions or the friends you make. I guess that's good advice. We see Scott and Nathan or Cable having a son to father heart to heart in Mirror Island, I'm assuming. And again, I'm looking at Mirror Island, and they got the lights on. They got a hangar full of, you know, jets and stuff. I'm assuming Moira's still alive, and that when we saw her body in Genosha, she was just like unconscious. Or maybe, you know, Moira gave Chuck a key and was like, "All right, Charles, in the event that I'm dead, just, you know, go and use Mirror Island as a second base or something." I don't know. They did have a romantic history, so it's possible. It's just going to be kind of weird if that's just the case. I'd rather go with Moira's alive, but I guess we could also go with Moira just gave Chuck an extra pair of keys, and this is just convenient. And they're, you know, deciding what to do. They're going to break up into two X-Men teams, Gold and I think Blue, which are also a nod to comics, because X-Men also broke off from Uncanny X-Men in the comics to form teams that could have a more titrated focus on certain characters, like Gold and Blue. These are, you know, real elements from the comics. We see all of the X-Men donning uniforms that are directly a throwback to that, you know, pilot I talked about, Pride of the X-Men. And, you know, they're wearing these old school costumes, like OG old school costumes. And it's so cool to see. It, again, it is nostalgia. This is a nostalgia trip. You know, we get to see Jean wearing her original Marvel Girl costume. So cool, with the mask. Like, she, you know, she doesn't usually wear a mask, but I guess she's wearing a mask now because nostalgia. Like, you don't need to conceal your identity. We all know you're Jean Grey. Your name is literally Jean Grey. You don't need to wear a mask. But, you know, I guess nostalgia trumps, you know, utility. Anywho, so Jean and Scott hug, and they're like, you know, I guess, good luck fighting demons and robots. And they go their separate ways. So Aurora and Jean and Forge are actually in a separate vehicle going to find Bastion. And they're with Morph. So they kind of went towards fighting Bastion on this little island in the middle of nowhere, right? And Cable went with them. So it's kind of like the Summers family split. And so Scott went instead with Nightcrawler and Wolverine and Jubilee and the rest of the team to Asteroid M. I'm just thinking, why would you put Wolverine anywhere near Magneto ever? Like, haven't we learned from the past about metal people and the master of magnetism? I kind of knew this was going to happen. I just saw the tea leaves and I'm like, they're going to pull from that comic arc, aren't they? They're going to have to. Asteroid M, Magneto, they're going to do that, aren't they? We'll get there. You know what I'm talking about. Ugh, I knew that was going to happen. And anyways, we see Cable and Jean and Morph and Beast on the ground in this kind of almost Savage Land-like environment. I'm assuming it's in a jungle climate somewhere. Looks a little Savage Land-like. And they're kind of trying to find Bastion and the activated Prime Sentinels. Right, while Storm and Forge are taking care of the Sentinels launched, you know, by Bastion into the atmosphere. And we see one of the coolest sequences. We see Morph turn into the Hulk. That's right. Morph turning into the friggin' Incredible Hulk and taking these Sentinels out, like Hulk style, because apparently Morph is strong enough to be able to turn into the Hulk and have all of the Hulk's powers? I didn't know he could do that. I mean, I thought his power set wasn't just the fact that he was big and strong, but that he has, like, I guess, gamma powers? Morph, can Morph, like manufacture a power set of anyone that he sees? Because that's incredible. That's almost like a Proteus-level, like, reality-altering powers. Anyway, we'll unpack that later. So we see Jean in this kind of weird jungle, kind of almost like a nuclear fallout testing site, like hometown looking place. We see Jean fighting Sinister. That's right. Just, you know, because I guess you have to pair up like people because, you know, the narrative requires it. You know, I thought, the writing, would Jean have to fight Sinister in the comics? I mean, yes, in the comics, you also do have that kind of, you know, dualistic pairing up of, you know, villain and hero. And Jean fighting Sinister, it does make a lot of sense, you know, with all that Sinister's done to the Summers family. And just seeing my favorite part of their fight was when Jean's just chucking freaking bowling balls at the guy. It's just funny because he's a pinhead. Because he's got a little head. Sinister, as always, has animated a smaller head than his body. So he's like a bowling pin. I digress. So, you know, they're fighting, and then we see the Blackbird kind of fly into Asteroid M. So out of, like, the comics and Pride of the X-Men, which took place, the battle scene in Pride of the X-Men took place on Asteroid M. So this is all Pride of the X-Men throwback, which, again, awesome to see. And, you know, Rogue and Sunspot are fighting with Magneto against the X-Men. It's like crazy, right? And, you know, Nightcrawler's bamfing around and dodging like magnetically altered metal scraps. And Magneto and Xavier are like, we're rhetorically battling, but we're not actually battling yet. Like, love it. So classic. It's classic. And Roberto just like nerfs Jubes. And then Jubilee's like, dude, we've been intimate and you've just shot me with like a solar blast. And then Roberto realizes it, and he's like, oh shit, yeah, like she and I, we're like a thing now. Maybe I shouldn't have just blasted her. I do like our pillow time. I know it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but it, you know, it's in the show, I can review it. And Xavier is trying to get Magneto to see reason and reverse the magnetic damage he's done to the Earth. And he's using his whole whammy to like talk to Scott. You need to blast his helmet off so I can take control of his mind. And it's just like so crazy fun. This episode made me so like glee all the time. I was just like glee, because it's just so quintessential X-Men. Like in watching part two of Tolerance is Extinction, I almost felt that I was reading a comic. Like, that's how much I've loved some of the action sequences in this show. It was very comic, but like, that's not a bad thing. Like, all of Marvel Studios, you know, including what, you know, they did with the first Iron Man, is all based on the comics. But it's just wonderful to see a property be self-referential. This is a cartoon. Cartoons are animated art. A cartoon is an animated comic. Like, it's just so meta when you're seeing this fight both on Asteroid M and down at Bastion's kind of island, and how like so comic book it is, which just it just makes me love the property even more. And you can look at this and say, well, it's, you know, it's a very Saturday morning cartoon. What do we think a comic book is, right? A comic book is a way that we experience a story narrative as quickly as we can through panels. And, you know, to take that and to turn it into a 30-minute animation, it takes a lot of work, takes a lot of ingenuity. And I've really loved kind of how they've done it. Now, yes, the whole Sinister fighting Jean, and, you know, you always have to pair up your major power players against each other. Yeah, that's a trope. You know, it happens in almost any superhero or superpowered story. You always have a pairing up of opposing good, bad, you know, power, ice, fire. You know, it's a kind of a thing. But I'm going to say, you know, X-Men and comic books like Marvel and Dark Horse and, you know, DC, a lot of our storytelling, it borrows from that narrative. We are inspired as artists by what we see, right? And comics are an inspiration for many other art forms and are referenced in many films. There are many films nowadays that have nothing to do with comics that have all been inspired by how comic book designers develop panels in the comic. What you look at, right? Where something is within a frame, how long you're looking at a certain frame. It's all based on work that was done by comic book authors, writers, and publicists. And it is, again, I had such fun watching this episode, this whole battle sequence. Just awesome how, you know, Xavier's helmet gets knocked off, and then Charles tries to take over him, and then, like, Scott shoots Xavier because he doesn't want the Prime Sentinels to be turned on and kill everyone on the island, including his wife, which causes Chuck to lose concentration. Helmet comes back to Magneto, but before he can get the helmet back on, Wolverine just stabs Magneto in the back. And everyone's like, oh shit. But I know why they were going oh shit. And maybe Logan didn't know why they're going oh shit. Logan's body is, all of his bones are laced in metal. And just like in the comics, which was a major part of the comics, Magneto rips the adamantium from Wolverine's bones. This is completely based in the comics. It was shocking when this happened in the comics. I remember as a kid, I had a X-Men trading card of just this instant because it was so huge. People were absolutely appalled. They were shocked. They didn't know what to expect. But that's why we love these stories. So I don't know what's going to happen next episode. There's so much in the air right now. We are literally ending this episode on the cliffhanger of cliffhangers. Magneto's been stabbed. Wolverine's metal's been ripped out of his bones by the bad guy. We don't know if Jean is alive. We don't know if Sinister is still controlling Nathan. We don't know if our characters are gonna make it into the future. But that's what we love about these stories. They get us on the edge of our seats. I was literally on the edge of my seat when this episode wrapped. And I watched it during my lunch break. And I'm just like, how can I focus now? Like, this was freaking fun. Like, it was just fun. I think this is probably one of the most fun episodes that I've seen in the series so far, with just the amount of stuff that was going on. And again, it didn't feel forced. Okay, maybe the Mr. Sinister Jean kind of pairing up fight, a little bit. But I loved almost all of it. I loved the art design. I loved the focus that they had on showing classic and contemporary. I think this show is such a credit to not only what Marvel as a property has done, but what Marvel Studios has become. And I don't think that Marvel Comics would have been able to reboot the series with this much talent, with this much production design, and this much writing prowess, if not for the success that they've had as a publishing company. So we're in like a golden age right now of comic book storytelling. I'd love to see it. I hope people don't get oversaturated. But I do have to say that I feel that this show is doing more for X-Men, definitely, but for people who love comics than any show since the original X-Men show that was on Fox. So I love it. I hope you loved it. Let me know, what was your favorite moment in this episode? And I'm so excited for the finale next week. I don't know what to expect. But there's just so much up in the air. Oh, so much fun. Well, until next time, thanks for listening and keep it classic.